business. We are in Eov, in Job, chapter 31. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want the bottom of page 1659. You see the sheets that I gave you / emailed you. So skip the outline part for now. I'm not starting with the outline. But go to the last page, which is a double-sided sheet, which covers chapter 31, picking up from where we left off last time, and then has the intro to chapter 32. God willing, we should make it there. But remember what we're involved with here. All the visitors have already finished, well, all the visitors we knew of finished their speeches. Job finished his responses to them. Job has three closing speeches. I'm modifying a little bit the way that I had initially presented it, because the more I go through it, the more I think you have to. Chapter 27 was really his response. Chapter 27 was Job's response to the visitors directly. Chapter 28 was his second closing address, in which he talked about the search for wisdom, right? We have the question of who the author of chapter 28 is. It's supposed to be Job speaking, narrator speaking, but that's the second address. That's the search for wisdom. The first one, as I wrote in the outline sheet, is more or less, I hate my visitors. Chapter 28 is the search for wisdom, rejection of this whole method of dialogue. And then chapters 29 to 31 is his closing address, in which he speaks of what God has done to him. So in chapter 29, he described how things had been wonderful, how he had helped the needy, how he had fought evil, how he carried out justice, and how he was honored, and he had wealth, and he had what he thought was security. And then in chapter 30, he described his downfall, how now he is mocked by lowly people, how he suffers brutally, and how God doesn't help him. And that brought us to the beginning of chapter 31, which is where we are now. Again, we're at the bottom of page 1659 in the Stone Tanakh. And as we said last time, we did a brief introduction of the chapter. This chapter is built around a series of oaths, in which Job swears to oaths. He swears regarding his good behavior. And we said that he's really the one on trial now, even though Job has tried to turn things around. The book was supposed to be the trial of humanity. That's what this book was supposed to be. God and the Satan having their dispute about the nature of human beings. Job, through the book, had turned it around and turned it into a trial of God, in which, you know, God chooses not to speak, but Job makes his allegations about God, and the visitors all feel the need to defend God. So it has become a trial of God. But now here, in this chapter, Job is back on trial, and he does, as defendants do, he swears to his righteousness. He's his own character witness. And he's going to go through a whole series of oaths about his good behavior. As we said last time, there are various ways to count the oaths. If you have the sheet that I gave out last time, I outlined one way to count them. It's not on the sheets this time. It's only on the sheets from last time. But I counted 10 sets of oaths regarding his behavior. And that's where we begin now. So we're at chapter 31, sentence 1. In which we get the first of his set of oaths, and he speaks of, well, it's really actually not. It's not an oath yet. The oath is coming. But he says, I have been righteous, and my righteousness has only brought me suffering. So, Pasuk Aleph, sentence 1, he says, Bris karati le'enai. I created a covenant. Lichrot brit is a standard term. It means to create a covenant, to agree to a covenant, literally to cut a covenant. But I agreed to this covenant for my eyes. Uma es bonein al bisula. Why would I look at a bisula, an unmarried woman? Job says, I swore to control my gaze where I would look. Now, when he speaks... Yeah, that had nothing to do with anything in this book. We haven't talked about that at all, right? And it's going to come up again. We're not done with it. It's going to come up later in this chapter as well. So where we are going to have to talk about, he's going to raise issues here and sins here that have not been discussed at all to date within this text.
Because it's Shomerim.
Yeah, may not. Well, Shomerim is over now.
Tots.
Okay, Tots. Right, Shomerim Tots. Right, Shomerim Tots. For those of you who didn't get it, don't worry about it. But it's true. This isn't something he's ever discussed. The issue of immorality hasn't really been on the table. There was, I think, actually one reference earlier when he talked about his wife leaving him with somebody to be with somebody else. I think there was a brief mention of it, or not his wife, Job's wife. Job's wife had six words in the book, and she was clearly there just to move the story forward, to push Job a little bit further when she told him he should just blaspheme and die. That was pretty much her script. But she performed it well, you know. Yeah, some people only get one line, but they put their energy into it. So this sentence here is not really, to my mind, about immorality at all. Rather, notice that his emphasis is on where he looks. It's not about an act. It's about where he looks. And where one looks is, as the Da'at Mikra suggests here, about one's desire. And what he's saying is, I would never even look outside of my own space. The classic phrase, my own Dalet Amos, my own four cubits. I would never look beyond that which is mine. I don't desire that which is not mine. And that's a theme that's been very big for him in terms of theft and injustice. He says, I would never look beyond what I have. I am righteous. And he continues to say, by the way, the sentence could be taken literally, and if we get to it, I brought you a source that does at the end of the chapter, but I didn't want to interrupt the flow of the chapter for it. So there is another way to look at it. But he continues to say in sentence two, Umeh chelek eloka mima'al v'nachalas shakai mimiromim. He says, and what has been the portion from God in heaven? In other words, I was so good. I didn't desire anything but that which I had, that which was mine. I never overstepped my boundaries. And what did I get for it? What was the portion sent to me by God above? What was the portion given by Shakai, by God, from the heavens? What did I get for it? That's the classic way to translate the sentence. There are, as always, other ways. What phrase in that sentence rings in particular from the Hebrew? There's a phrase there in that sentence that becomes quite popular, taking it entirely out of context. Chelek Elokam Mimal. Anyone ever hear that phrase? Chelek Elokam Mimal is the standard phrase used to refer to the neshama, to refer to the soul. A portion of God or from God above. But it has nothing to do with the context here. I mean, here in context, he's saying, what did I get from God for all my righteousness? So we have to come back to that at the end of the chapter also, this phrase, chelek elokam imal, if we have time to do it. But he says, halo eid le'aval, v'necher lefal le'aven. He says, what did I get? What I got was the aid for the aval. Aid is a term we've used before as a time of downfall for the wicked. Aid, Aleph Yud Dalid, is taken, literally, it's often used as just an appointed time. But it's often used as a time when the wicked are going to suffer. Liyom Eidam, the day of their aid. So he says, what happened to me? I was so good. What did I get for it? I had the fate of the wicked. V'necher lefo'alei oven. The word necher is an interesting word. Da'at Mikra renders it as an ason, as a catastrophe. The catastrophe that befalls people who do bad things. That's what I got. So this is his introduction to the chapter in which he's going to outline and swear to his good behavior. Clear? I'm pushing the pace a little bit because there's so much that we have to see this year that we're running out of time for. So he says in Pasuk Dalet, Halo hu yir ed rachai. God sees my ways. V'chol tse'adai yispor. And he counts my steps. And here we get oath number one. Im halachti im shav. V'tachash al mirma ragli. If, and the if is the language of the oath, but he says, I can swear. He says, I never halachti im shav. I never walked with shav. Shav meaning falsehood. Like shuat shav, which can be taken on multiple levels, but its basic level is a false oath. I never walked with falsehood. Vatachash al mirma ragli. And my feet never rushed. Chush is to hasten. My feet never rushed for mirma, for trickery. I never rushed to trick anybody. So his first oath is of honesty. I had no deception, and God knows it because he sees all my ways. He counts all my steps. He knows exactly, he has a Fitbit. God knows exactly what I do and where I've been, and he knows that I'm honest. That's number one. Number two, Pasuk Vav, sentence six. Yishkaleni b'mozne tzedek. God can weigh me with honest scales. V'yeda lokatumasi. God will know that I am tum, that I am complete, perfect, and we know that God knows it because that was the very first sentence in the book. He is indeed. What he's saying is 100% true. Do not read this as someone who is puffing himself up or is trying to justify himself. The book told us at the beginning, this is true. Everything we're going to say here, everything that Job is going to swear, is 100% true. Granted that there are those who have had trouble with this and have tried to, pick at Job here and there. But fundamentally, we were told in the start of the book that he is Tam v'yashar v'yirei Elokim, right? He's perfect, he's straight, and he is God-fearing. Don't take that away from him. So he says, God can weigh me on honest scales, or the scales of honesty. God knows, tumati, my perfection. Im tite ashuri mini hadarech. If my gaze, my expression, where I look, ever stray from the path, ve'achar einai halach libi, did my heart ever follow my eyes? Uvechapai davak me'um, did anything ever stick to my hands? Did I ever take anything from anybody else? Ezra av achir yochel, he said, if I ever did such a thing, then I should plant and other people should eat it. In other words, I would deserve to lose all of my wealth if I took from somebody else, if even wanted that which somebody else had. My descendants should be uprooted. He says, I would deserve what I am experiencing if I was guilty of this. Yes, Carl?
I have a completely different translation here.
That's okay.
Let the produce of my field be rooted out.
Yeah, I saw that also, because in context, it's not talking about his children. And so they have difficulty with it. So it's true. Some will render the tzedza in here as not my children who I produce, but the children of my deeds, which is to say that which I produce. I mean, in general, you're going to see a lot of, multiple ways to read sentences. I'm trying to pare it down to present one message. But yes, you can do more with it. And so what he's saying is, what happened to me should happen to me. If I was dishonest, if I took from others, you bet I'd be the first one to say that. Not only that, Mitzudat David takes it even stronger. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, not the outline sheet, but the other, Mitzudat David says that he's saying, I wish that would happen to me. Not only an acceptance of, I would deserve it, but that's what I would push for. Mi yitein asher yishkaleni b'moz leitzedek. I wish he would weigh me in just scales. Lasum zchuyotai l'umat avonotai, putting my merits opposite my sins. Az yida lokat tumasi. Then he would know my perfection. Ki hazchuyot yachuyu, because the merits would weigh down the scale. And if I was guilty, then this is what happened to me. Then these terrible things would happen. But yeah, I wish he would weigh me. Maybe he isn't saying I wish I would be punished if I was guilty, because he doesn't believe he's guilty. Maybe he's just saying I wish God would weigh me, because I know how it would come out. But that's his second oath. His first oath is, I deceived nobody. Right? That was his first oath. I deceived no one. God can count my steps. I never rushed to do anything bad. Number two, I have stolen nothing. And now, in sentences 9 to 12, we get his third oath, and here he comes back to the immorality theme. He's a little bit strong in his language. I'm going to skirt it a little bit. But he says in sentence 9, Im niftali bi al isha, if my heart was ever seduced for a woman, Val Pesach Rei Aravti, if I ever lay in ambush by the door of, by the entrance of my friend's house, Titchan la'acher ishti ve'aleha yichra'un acherin. You can read the translation yourself. But he says, I should lose my wife if that was me. The same way that if I did this to the property of others, then I should lose my property. If I would do this with someone else's wife, then I should lose mine. Ki hi zima v'hu avon pelilim. Because this would be zima, immorality, and it's a crime. It's a terrible crime. So he says, absolutely, then I would deserve to have this happen to me. Ki eish hi ad avadon tochel. This is a fire. It consumes all the way down to the depths. Ubechol tivuasi tisharesh, and it would root after my produce. And there we see the word tivua as opposed to tzehet sahim. But he says, this would be such a horrible crime that, of course, such a thing should happen to me. It's interesting that he goes after this one with such harsh terms. He didn't use the same harsh language for the other ones. It's also interesting that, as was noted before, this is a new theme for the book. This hasn't been part of his conversation at all. This wasn't alleged by any of his visitors. Even when Eliphaz got really harsh and said to him, "Oh, I know all about you, Job, and you harmed the widow and the orphan, and made all sorts of terrible allegations about him." No one ever accused him of this in the first place. It's not really clear to me, why this suddenly comes. Well, no, not it's not really clear. It's not clear to me why this is suddenly a theme here in the story. Yes. Right, so he's just coming up with a laundry list of potential sins. Sort of like on Yom Kippur when you have the Al Chait. Right, there are a bunch of things in the Al Chait that I've never been anywhere near that. But I'll just mention those too. To which the response is, well, that's why it's in the plural, because you may not have, but the person sitting next to you might have. Yes?
I'm sure it's been allegorized as,
not literally. Sorry. Yeah.
Allegorized as his relationship with Hashem. Right? Because all of a sudden he comes so hard just on that. And in those days, he could have had more than one wife, I'd assume.
Right. Now, it's true that it's from a period of polygamy. That is so. But he specifies the wife of another and the entrance of someone else's house. It's not as though he's talking about something that is anachronistic in that sense. But in terms of your first point, the association potentially with idolatry, the problem is he's actually going to bring up idolatry separately too. And idolatry also hasn't been a theme in the book. The only time that as far as I can recall, the only mention of idolatry we've seen is when he turned to the visitors and said, "You have this false conception of God, and you are idolatrous because you're worshiping something other than God." Idolatry has been as little a theme in this book as sexual immorality. Those haven't been part of the conversation. It's been much more about the way you behave towards other people and your personal loyalty to God, not in terms of this God versus idolatry, but this God versus rebellion. There's never been, we haven't named any other gods, certainly not explicitly within this. There are references to ancient demons and whatever else, but there's been no, it's not as though he said, Baal Peor sounds nice today. Yes?
But you know what? These are hidden sins. He's been talking about all those sins before. These are hidden sins. This is a different order. If you want somebody else's wife and lust for her and stuff, that's a hidden thing. This is like another order, maybe a higher order.
Well, this isn't hidden. The opening sentence would have been something hidden because it's only the desire, but this one, he's talking about acting on it.
Yeah, but it's a continuation of the sexual theme.
I don't know. Maybe.
I just find it a little amusing that the people who, if he did indeed sin, the people who suffer are his children and his wife. I guess it's a sign of the way people thought at the time. But
what do you mean? Where do you see that?
Well, his wife.
Well, that's not her suffering. That's her betraying him.
She's never
wrong. Yeah.
If his wife is going to be suffering, his children are going to be.
No, that's not the reference in Pasuk Yud in sentence 10 is then she should be unfaithful to him with somebody else.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the reference in 10, is that then she should be unfaithful too.
What does our scroll translate that in? Some sort of interesting...
Someone could read it into you later. I don't know, but yeah. They're actually at the top of 1661, come to think of it. So that's his third one. And then he moves on to the fourth one, which is a very interesting one in its own right. He talks about treatment of slaves. Now, remember that Judaism, going all the way back to biblical text, is accepting of the concept of slavery. Mind you, it's not the North American version of slavery. It's a very different legal entity. Slavery, as it's conceived biblically, and certainly as it plays out in the various laws that are recorded in the Gemara and the Rambam and then in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law, is essentially a person who says, I can't support myself. I will barter away my freedom for the sake of being supported by somebody else. That's the concept of slavery as it appears. So that, normally, employment law, as it's conceived of within the Torah, is that the employee has full freedom. The employee is able to leave at any time. He forfeits, obviously, the rest of his wages, but he gets paid for the work he did, unless you're dealing with a case in which, by leaving, he's going to destroy the work that he already did, which is another story. But other than that, the employee is allowed to leave at any time. The person who accepts that he's going to become a slave forfeits that right and says, for the duration of this period, I am going to be enslaved. As the Gemara says, one who acquires an eved, one who acquires a slave, acquires a master for himself. The Gemara talks about, I'm actually going to bring one example of it here, giving the better food and giving the better clothing and the better bed to the slave, rather than keeping it for oneself. There are certain distinctions when it comes to the slave who is a Jew versus the slave who is a non-Jew. So when it comes to acquiring a Jew as a slave, it only can happen in one of two ways. One way is if he is broke and says, I need to sell myself, or theoretically the parent of the minor child says, I can't support the child, and sells the child to be a slave. In order to be supported. If it's a girl, then she's freed at the age of majority and so forth, all the laws that actually were in the Torah reading last week. And then the other way is if they steal from someone and they're not able to pay for that which they stole, so then once again they'll be sold as a slave until they're able to pay it back. Those are your two cases. When you're dealing with a non-Jewish slave, there's an added possibility, which is war. The prisoner of war. However, with the non-Jewish slave, there's a very interesting restriction which the Gemara mentions. You know, there's a lot of concern within Jewish law about division between Jews and non-Jews because of influence. Concern that if you're around idolaters too much, then they will become an influence on you. So you can imagine then the nightmare involved in bringing a non-Jewish slave right into your house. Right? They're believers in fill in the blank God, and they're going to live in your house and be around your family, you know, full time. So therefore, the halacha is that you're only allowed to accept them as a slave in the event that they agree to start a conversion process to Judaism, which will be completed when they are freed. And if you try to compel them to do so, then it doesn't work. Forced conversion is not valid, and you have up to a year for this process of them thinking about this. After that, you have to get rid of them. You can't keep them around. That's the basic introduction to the laws of slavery. There's a lot more, as always, to be said. Whether it was always practiced this way is another story. When I had my first shul, there was a fellow named Jonathan Schorsch who came around the shul from time to time. He wrote a remarkable thesis, which was published in shorter form as a book on the relations between Jews and African Americans in the, I think it was 16th to 19th centuries in North America. And it was fascinating in terms of what happened and where they did follow the rules and where they did not follow the rules. Very interesting story. But keep that in mind as we, all of this, you know, about the nature of slavery, as you read the following sentences. Sentence 13. Yeah?
Did you say, when can a slave leave?
So a slave leaves under the following conditions. A Jewish slave leaves automatically after 6 years. You're not allowed to keep him longer unless he says, I want to remain, in which case he can stay until the Yovel year, the Jubilee year, which occurs every 50 years. Not that he's a slave for 50 years, but every 50 years is a Jubilee year, and at that point he has to be freed and he doesn't have a choice about staying at all. That's the Jewish slave. There is no such liberation for the non-Jewish slave. There's no mandatory liberation at that point. There's even some debate in general about when, if at all, one has a specific Torah, license to free him. The other exception is if you wound the slave. If you wound the slave goes free. Which kinds of wounds and all that, that's why we have law. So, but that's the other basic rule. Yeah. So when we read in the beginning of the book, when we described his wealth, we said, right back to chapter 1, he had all sorts of cattle, he had camels, he had donkeys, and then he had va'avuda rabam me'od. Right? It was chapter 1, sentence 3. So avuda could be rendered as workers, but as I understand it, this is a reference to slaves. Yeah, that would be my understanding. So, take a look now what he says here in starting with sentence 13. It's 13 to 15. Im emas, this is his fourth oath by my count. Im emas mishpat avdi va'amasi v'rivam imadi. He swears that he never rejected the justice of his eved or ama, his male or female slave, when they had a quarrel with him. He says, I never dismissed their claim. He says, how could I defend myself to God had I done this? Because it's the same power relationship. If I, as the master, would dismiss the claim of my slave, then God would be right to dismiss my claims. Halo vabeten oseini asahu. He says, in the same womb that God made me, he also made the slave. Vayechunenu berechem echad. We were formed in the same womb. We are all human beings, and I do not have the right, bless you, I do not have the right to discount their claim to justice. That's Job's statement. It's a very interesting and strong statement, and now I refer you to the sheets. First, take a look at source number 2. This is a passage from a larger piece in Masechet Ketuvot, in the Yerushalmi version of it. Rabbanan de Kesarin b'shem Rabbi Acha mitzuvin. Rabbanan de Kesarin b'shem Rabbi Acha. The rabbis of Caesarea quoted Rabbi Acha as saying, "Mitzuvin Yisrael lefarnes kita'in afilu avadim." He said, "Israel is instructed to support amputees. If you see people who had a limb amputated and therefore they can't support themselves, you have to go out and support them, and that includes slaves who were freed because they were wounded by the master," is what he's talking about. Rabbi Yochanan, and then they talk about Rabbi Yochanan, one of the leading sages, min koma dahava achil, from everything he ate, that should be ate, not are, sorry, spell check missed that one, from whatever Rabbi Yochanan ate, yahiv la'avde, he would give to his slave, vavakari aloi, and he would quote this verse, which I didn't bother to translate on the sheet, because it's what we just read in here. Halo bebeten oseini oseihu, vayechonenu berechem echad. We were formed from the same womb. The same God who made me made him. And therefore, I have to treat him well. So I went looking to see whether this was a popular verse among the abolitionists, right, against slavery. And lo and behold, I found Jonathan Edwards. Source number 3, this is from his notes on, as you see, the Holy Scriptures, the Reverend Jonathan Edwards. He said, in these two things are contained the most forcible reasons against the master's abuse of his servant, that both have one maker, and that their maker made them alike with the same nature. He said, this verse teaches me those two points, and so he quoted that as part of the argument against abuse of slaves. So the answer is yes. This was read, and it was taken seriously in arguments against abuse of slavery. So that's his fourth oath, right? So he has sworn that he deceived no one. He has sworn that he stole nothing. He has sworn that he was moral. And he has sworn that he was always fair with his slaves. Had them, but treated them fairly. Clear so far? Okay. Continuing then, sentences 16 to 20 are his fifth oath. Sentence 16. Im emna mechefetz dalim ve'enei almana achale. He says, I never kept from the needy that which they wanted. I never let the eyes of the widow be disappointed. I never let them down. I always made sure to help them. Ve'ochal piti levadi v'lo achal yaso mimena. I never ate my bread alone without sharing it with an orphan. Ki mine'urai. Now here, the next couple of verses admit of multiple explanations. I'm not going to go with everybody's translations and so forth. I'm sticking with one that I think is coherent. He says, Ki mine'urai gedelani che'av u'ibeten imi anchena. He says, from my youth, gedelani means the orphan was raised with me, as though I was the father of the orphan. And from the womb of my mother, I would lead her, according to Ibn Ezra, which I brought you in source number 4, refers to the widow. I always supported her. Other explanations say it's about him supporting his mother. But either way, he says, my whole life, I supported these needy people. Im ereh oved mibli levush. If I ever saw someone who was oved, and we talked about last time the problem of the word oved, but if I ever saw somebody who was lost not in the sense of needing directions, but lost in the sense of ruined, this person who did not have clothing, veink susla evyon, a needy person who lacked clothes. Im lo verchuni chalatzav umigez kivasai yischamam. See if his loins did not bless me, meaning I gave him clothing to cover himself. And from the shearing of my sheep, he was warmed. I made sure that I would provide for him. So his fifth oath says that he did what? He took care of others. Not only does he not deceive people, but he goes out of his way to be benevolent and to help them. Yeah, Rita.
But people aren't really accusing him of all this stuff. He's just taking all these oaths to cover every aspect. Right.
So I would say two things. One was that Eliphaz at one point did make the open accusation. Again, we debated whether Eliphaz was serious or not, but we did see that. But the other is that, yeah, this chapter is really him versus God. He's done with the visitors. In chapter 29, in chapter 27, he finished with the visitors and told them how much he hated them. This is now him versus God. And he's saying, God, I can swear to my innocence on this whole long list of potential charges. So you please explain to me what it is that's going on. Why is it, where in your justice system does it make sense that I suffer as I do? That's what's going on here, as I understand it. He now says, I didn't cheat the vulnerable. By the way, interrupt me if you have questions. I realize that I'm going relatively quickly, but I'm happy to give my voice a rest. Pasuk Chavala, sentence 21. Im hanifosi al yasom yadi, ki ereh vashar ezrasi. He says, I did not raise my hand against the orphan when I saw him at the gate. Ki ereh vashar ezrasi, when I saw my Ezra, meaning my friend and supporter, at the gate. What is the gate in Tanakh? We've talked about this before. What happens at the gate?
Judgment,
right. So when I was the judge at the gate, and the orphan showed up, and my friend was the litigant on the other side, I did not favor my friend. And he says, "Ksefi mishichmati pol ve'ezroi like zroi mikanati shaver." He said, "If I had done that, I would deserve that my shoulder should fall from its place. I would deserve a broken arm." He says, "If I had done that, if I had used my power to help my friend and harm the needy." Ki fachad elai aid kel umiseiso lo uchal. He says, if for no other reason than that I'm afraid of divine justice, I will be afraid of the aid, the day of punishment that God would bring upon me. Because of God's power, I can't possibly do this. I can't violate God's will in this way. And then he gets to idolatry. Not just idolatry, but placing his faith in something other than God. He says, I was always loyal to God. Pasuk Chaf Dalet, sentence 24. Im samti zahav kisli. If I ever, and this is again an oath, he says, if I ever made gold kisli, my hope. If you remember way, way back, Eliphaz's first speech, he said, Halo yiras cha kislasecha. Your awe for God was always what you put your hope in. That was when Eliphaz was trying to buck up his spirits in the beginning. So he says, I never made my gold, I never made gold into my hope, that which I trusted in. I never said to ketem, which is another word for gold, I never said that that was my security. That wealth wasn't where I placed my hope. Im esmach ki rav cheli v'chi kabir matza yadi. I was never joyous because I had a lot of wealth and because my hand had achieved power. Im ereh or ki yahel v'yareach yakar holech. So this is usually understood as a line about idolatry. He said, I never, this is part of his oath, all these ims in this sequence are all successive oaths, part of the same oath. He says, I never saw the light when it shone forth. Yahel, like Behilo that we saw before, the shining forth of light. Someone emailed me, one of the people who catches the shiur online, when we had the conversation about Behilo and Halo. So he hastened to note that Halo would get it from Helios, and the light of the sun, Helos, and the light of the sun. And yes, that is certainly true. Our point was the cognate, not the etymology. But in any case, the in or ki yahel, he says, I didn't look at the light when it was bright, meaning to honor the light of the sun, v'yareach yakar holech, or to look at the radiance of the moon as it travels. Meaning, I didn't worship the sun, I didn't worship the moon. Vayift baseser libi vatishak yadi lefi. My heart was not seduced by idolatry in secret, and I never put my hand to my mouth to kiss it. Now, we've seen the expression putting one's hand to one's mouth earlier in the book in the context of an expression of shock or amazement. But that's not what he's referring to here. Rather, this was considered to be an idolatrous gesture. In lieu of kissing the idol, he would be kissing his hand. And he says, I never did that. And he says, Pasuk Chavchet, sentence 28, Gam hu avon pelili, just like he said regarding immorality earlier, he says, this would be a terrible crime. Ki chichashti lakel mimal, because I would be denying God above. So this oath is an oath about placing his faith in his wealth or his faith in other gods. And again, it's a theme we haven't seen at all in this book. The issue of trusting in your wealth we've seen. The issue of trusting other gods is not one that we've seen before. And maybe it is just a checklist of charges. I don't know. But he says, I never went that route. Clear? Are we clear? If not, I'll have to say, yes, Alicia.
Do you think it could be a parallel, like these 10 oaths in the Sarah Hefti Brot? And he's sort of, maybe, I don't know if he's flipping the first five are Vandam Chedera, second are Vandam Lakum, and he's kind of looking at that as he's almost making up his own.
Right. So this is a very interesting question. I was wondering about it also as we were reading through this. Could you say that this is parallel to the Ten Commandments in some way? So, no. Look, 10 and 10 is always fun, and the truth is that there's some discussion about other sets of 10s among God's commands, like in Parshas Mishpatim, aside from the set of 10 that we see in Yitro. But, for example, you'd have to stretch it to find Shabbos in here. You know? I mean, there are some that lend themselves to it. I didn't warp judgment, and I didn't testify, you know, dishonestly, and obviously the immorality one in Lotina. Like, there are some that work better than others. But
it could be the judgment that you mentioned.
Right? So again, you'd have to really stretch for some of them in order to find them here. And more to the point, 10 is my convention for reading it, but you really could read these oaths differently and come up with a different number.
So the tens are 17.
So yeah, it all depends on whether you count each im independently. I don't, because I think some of them are clearly just reinforcing the same point. But you could read this legitimately as 12, as 14. Like there are other ways to do this count. Okay. So he's up to, in my count, number 8. He says, number 8, I never looked for my enemy to fall. Im esmach b'fid misanei. If I ever rejoiced at the fid being catastrophe. We saw this sentence last chapter, we saw this word, fid, in pido, right, in the previous chapter. I never rejoiced at the downfall of my enemy. V'hisorarti kimitzaora. I was not aroused to be happy when bad things happen to him. And not only that, I never set my palate to sin by asking for a curse against his life. I never cursed my enemy. I never wished bad on anybody. Which is also, you know, I think it's an interesting point that he's making. It's beyond the generic, I helped other people, I didn't hurt other people. He's saying, if I had an enemy, I never wished anything bad to happen to them. And then we get number 9. Number 9 goes back to the more conventional. Chesed, kindness, taking guests. He says, Im lo amru misei ahali mi yitain mi bisaro lo nisba. He says, also an oath. He swears that the residents of his house, he doesn't mean his family, he means his guests, the people who came into his house, they would declare, we wish that we would not be full. In other words, I kept giving them and giving them, and they would say, you know, I wish I wasn't full so I could continue to benefit from his generosity. Bachutz lo yalin ger, the stranger never slept outside, they always came into my house. Dilasai lo orach eftach, I opened up my doors to the orach. Orach would be the path, or orach is a guest. Either way, it's the same point. But saying I opened up my doors to the path, what does that sound like?
Avraham.
Sorry, it sounds like?
Avraham,
right? The whole thing about Avraham having doors open on each side to make sure that people from the path could come in. So take a look on your source sheet at number 5. I bring this, it's one of several midrashim that honors Job and yet shows how Avraham was greater. It's part of a really necessary discussion in its own right about Avraham and Eov, because there's a lot to be said on that front. But take a look at source number 5. You think about, you know, Avraham being somebody who gets 10 tests, right, versus Job who has his test here. So that's sort of one angle on it. But I think there's more to be done with it in the mythical realm in which we have time at the end of the year. But take a look at number 5. It's from Avos to Rabbi Nassan. Avos to Rabbi Nassan is an expansion of Pirkei Avot. So they're commenting on the Mishnah that says, Yihi beischa pasuach lirvacha, that your house should always be wide open. And it says, Kederach shahaya beiso shel Eov, pasuach litzafon uldarom u'mizrach u'lmarav. Just like Job's house was open in all four directions. North, south, east, and west. V'kach haya Eov omer, and this is what Job would say, Mikol makom sheyavo adam l'sham yikanes. From any direction, people should be able to enter. And they quote exactly this verse, L'asai la'orach eftach, that my doors are open to the path. Hischil Eov omer. So Job used to say, and that's what we've been reading, Ani lo ayisi osek ha'acherim. I didn't do what other people did when they were hosts. Other people would eat the bread made of clean flour, and they would give the paupers bread from coarse flour. They'd give them inferior items. Acherim hem lovshim bigdei milsin. Other people will wear fine silk clothing. Umabishim laniyim bigdei sakin, and they would clothe paupers in sackcloth. Ani lo asisi kein. I didn't do that. Ela mimasha ayisi ochel ayisi machil aniyim. From what I ate, I gave to the needy. Umimasha yisi lovesh, from what I wore, hayisi malbish la'aniyim, I gave to the needy. Shenamar, and he quotes you the verse we saw before, which said that I gave them the wool from my own sheep. That was what they used to clothe themselves. So Job says, you know, I really went above and beyond what's considered the norm here. And again, the subtext is, so why is God doing this to me? But then the Medrash continues. Hischel Eov Mishtabeach. So Job began to praise himself. The Omer, and he used to say, Ma asa Avram Avinu below asisi ani. What did Avram Avinu do that I didn't do? Whether that means that Job is Jewish, and he's saying our father, or whether it's the Medrash saying Avinu for Avraham, doesn't really matter, because this is not necessarily meant to be taken as a literal sentence of, yeah, Job, you know, sat around talking about Avraham. As much as we know Avraham sits out by the road to look for guests, and Job is described as saying, I opened my door to the road. So now what we're going to do is contrast Avraham with Job. And you know who's going to win. Mm. So, Amar lo Eov, Job says to him, Ad masayatam mishtabeach ata. Im lo ba'ani lesoch beisecha lo yisamarach. I'm sorry, Amar lo, he said to him, is where the comma should be. I rendered that wrong. Amar lo, he said to him, we don't know who he is. It's God, Avram, I don't know. But he said to him, Eov, Job, how long are you going to praise yourself? Ata, you, im lo ba'ani l'soch beischa lo yisa merachem alav. You, if a pauper didn't come into your house, you wouldn't have mercy for him. He came into my house, and then. Aval Avraham lo asa came. That's not what Avraham did. Look at the description of Avraham. Elam yom shlishi, on the third day, from the third day after his bris, halach v'yashav lo ha-pesach ha-halo, he went and sat at the entrance to his tent, shenemar v'yoshev pesach ha-oel kechom hayom, he sat at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day, and he saw the people passing, and he ran out to greet them, and so forth. Yeah?
It comes across as a little bit unfair. Maybe Eov was sitting in the with his binoculars in his house and looking around.
Correct. Correct. We're only going
on the street and shout out, come to me.
Well, maybe.
But then Avram should have done the same thing.
And maybe he did. The problem is we don't know. We're working from the verses that we have. I mean, we're operating on two levels, at least two levels in this medrash. Level number one is showing the contrast between Job's verse here, defending his actions, and the description of Avraham, in which Job describes how I opened my house to the gate, to the doors, I opened my house to the road, but Avraham we see actually running out to the road. So on one level, it's simply a basic read of verses, and as always, the ear of Medrash. The rabbis paying attention to nuances in the text. Don't just read these as generic phrases, but ask yourself, what do these mean? That's one level. And then the second level is this question of, if Job is so righteous, how could these terrible things happen to him? And so what it's saying is, aha, but yeah, look, he was great, but look at Avraham. Avraham was even greater. So I think both levels are being satisfied here. We're looking at the language in the text, which is in front of us, and not saying, well, maybe Job did more, and that's what he didn't talk about, you know, in this chapter. And we're also saying, how do we reconcile his suffering? Well, maybe as good as he wasn't as good as others. You know, sort of a Zophar style argument of maybe you could have been even greater. Yeah, Rita. Correct. And that's always the weakness of the arguments of, well, Job wasn't perfect. You don't have to be perfect in order to avoid such a horrible disaster. Right. That and the weakness of the opening sentences of the book, which sure made it sound like he's perfect, because that's what the word Tom means.
That's the whole Tom of the whole
yes.
thing.
Yep. Nonetheless, that was his ninth oath, and then we get his tenth. And he says, Pasuk Lama Gimel, sentence 33. In kisisi adam pshaai, if I ever covered up my sins as people do, litmon bechubi avoni, to hide my sin in me, in my shirt, in my cloak. He says, I never hid anything that I did wrong. In other words, I'm not claiming to be good while covering up my sins. Ki erotz hamon rabba, ubuz mishpachos yechiteni, v'edom lo eitzei pasach. He says, I would never do that. Out of fear of, and I'm taking the JPS translation here because I found that it worked well. I would be afraid of erotz, like to be afraid, like lo ta'arotz mipnehem. I would be afraid of the masses, the shame that would be heaped upon me by families, and I would be silent and I would stay home. He says, if I ever did anything wrong, I would be too upset. I couldn't hide it. It's not that I sinned in secret. I hid nothing. Everything that I've declared to you about my righteousness here is true, and I won't. I would never deny any sins. And so he says, what is happening to me is entirely undeserved. And he concludes the last five sentences saying, you know, I wish that somebody would argue on my behalf. He says, "Mi yitain li shomei ali." I wish, mi yitain is a formulation we've seen a lot. I wish that somebody would listen to me. Hein tavi shakai ya'aneni. He says, that mikra offers a couple of different explanations here, but he says, my tav, meaning my mark, my seal, the shakai ya'aneni, this is my mark. It is for God to answer me. The sefer kasav ish rivi. I wish that my co-litigant here, meaning, you know, God, would write a book in response. This is everything I have. This is what I have to put out there. And now it's up to God to respond to me. Im lo al shichmi esa enu. He said, I would carry that book on my shoulder. And denu ataros li, I would tie it as a crown for me. Mispar tse'adai agidenu, I would tell God the count of my steps. Kimo nagid akaravenu, I would draw God close, like a nagid, a prince, a leader. Im alai admasi tizak, if against me the ground would cry out. Right, as the ground cries out because of the sins committed there, going all the way back to Cain. V'yachad talameha yivkayun, and together its furrows would weep. Im kocha achalti b'li chasef, if I ate the fruit of the ground without paying for it, meaning I stole. V'nefesh be'alei yipachti, and the soul of its owners I killed, or caused them to be down the crestfallen, that's the word. Tachas chita yetzechoach, may thorns come out in place of wheat. Vesachas seora basha, and in place of the barley that I would plant. I wish that I would get basha instead. The basha being a plant that you do not want, some kind of a wild grass, according to the Da'at Mikra. Tamu divrei Iyov. Yeah. Job says, that's it, God. I said everything there is to be said. Yes.
It's so interesting that even though he does say that he is not the saint, that he's not perfect, in a real reflective mood, he could have come up with something he has done wrong, put it out there and say, really, was that worth
all
it? But he doesn't mention even one thing.
Correct.
Which he may have done wrong.
There is nothing on my record to say. Correct. He says, there's nothing. Here's a whole long list of charges that people get brought up on. Not this, not this, not this, not this, not this.
Even though he says,
yeah,
I may have done something.
There have been one or two points in the book where he said, and even if I've done something wrong, God, is it really worthy of this? But he never specified anything. There has been not a thing. You know, and now you can picture him, you know, delivering this last speech and saying, and im this, and im this, and im lo that, and im lo that, and then, you know, sort of, you know, drop the mic, walk off, and your turn. You know, that's it. He's done, and he is done. He is going to have a couple of responses to God when God speaks, but this was his last speech. Now, a couple of quick notes. We have like 5 minutes left, so I just wanted to note two things, going back to the beginning of the chapter. If you take a look at your sheet, it's source number 6. I wanted to note here on that sentence of Brit Karati Le'enai, when he said that, you know, I would never look at a bitula. So bitula is an unmarried woman. And as Ari pointed out, this is during the days of polygamy. So what's the big deal? So the Medrash looks at this and says, no, I'll tell you what this is about. Hechmir Iyov al Atzmo. Job was strict with himself. Even if she was single, he wouldn't gaze upon her. And so they say, this is a kal v'chomer. Kal v'chomer means from light to strong. If he wouldn't do this, how much more so he wouldn't do other things. So they say here, umayim bisula zu. If you're talking about a girl who is single, shem yirtza yisa'en ala atzmo livno le'achivu le'krovo, where he could marry her himself, or maybe a relative of his would marry her, and yet, hechmir Iyov al atzmo, Job was strict with himself. V'lo nistakel, but he didn't look at her. Eishes ish al achas kama v'kama, how much more so he would never look at someone who was married to somebody else. That's the initial statement. So why was he so strict with himself? Because Job said, Shema estakel ani hayom, ulamachar yavo ish acher v'yisa ena v'nimtza sheni mistakel v'esh es ish. Because she's only single today. What happens next week? She gets married to somebody else, and then I will have looked at a woman who's married to somebody else. So the message here is that Job takes extra steps of piety, but this gets quoted. This line of Job gets quoted regarding the importance of being careful about what you gaze at. Gazing doesn't mean you see somebody else. Gazing means looking with intent. That's what we're talking about. The Gemara talks about that. But that was one piece that I wanted to show you, is the way that they look at what Job says here. The other is just to note, again, this reference to the neshama, to the soul, as chelak elokam imal, the portion of God above, even though it's not in context, the portion of God above means the way I've suffered. But it is a phrase that's used to describe the soul as being a component somehow, and what that means is mystical, but a component of God above. So we're not going to start on Elihu now, but I also wanted to make sure you notice that on your sheets you have an outline. This is an update of the outline I gave you in the beginning of the year, which went from chapters 1 to 19. So I've updated. We have actually covered already this year 20 to 31. I feel good about that. Of course, we still have 32 to 42 to go. But I tried to give you sort of high points here so that you could read through it, see what's new in particular chapters. Where is there something that is new? And hopefully that will help you as you review for the final. Hopefully it will come in handy. As always, email me with questions or thoughts on it. And God willing, next week, enter Elihu. We will meet the silent fourth beetle, who's been there the whole time, apparently.